All right, Erev Tov. I want to start off with some sad news. Just a few hours ago, our dear friend Chesky Wang died. I just sent out the phone squad, literally the last couple of hours, so the wise tomorrow. So I thought of canceling the shiur tonight, but I know that Chesky would have wanted me to go on, especially with this topic. So dedicated in his memory, and he should be a source of strength to all of us. Tonight, Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, Part 11, we're talking about Rav Meir Kahana, Shem Kom Damo, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishnas, Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Of all the rabbis in this series, so they're all great, but greatness comes in different forms. One definition of greatness, as I see it, is consequential, meaning rabbis who did things of consequence that carved a new path. So in that sense, Meir Kahana was great. One doesn't have to agree with every statement or action or policy position to realize and appreciate that he was a person of great consequence. So we've discussed in the past great Rosh Yeshiva, great Poskim, leaders of Musar, trailblazers, all of whom solidified or innovated some aspect of the Torah world. Rabbi Kahana was a pulpit rabbi briefly. He was a Rosh Yeshiva as well. He was a writer of Svarim, but in none of those capacities did he make his mark. It was in a different realm entirely, related to all of the above, but unique to him. In short, he was a leader. A leader, though, who struggled to find followers. He was a trailblazer who immersed himself in so many different topics and who spoke his mind so freely that easily he's the most controversial rabbi we'll encounter in this series. He was a gadfly, he was a lightning rod, he was a person who spoke the truth as he saw it without compromise, without wishy-washiness, and he led in so many different spheres: Jewish self-defense, the plight of Russian Jewry, assimilation on campuses and in American life, the pitfalls of non-orthodoxy, Aliyah, the right of Jewish settlement in the land of Israel, the right of Jews to the land of Israel, the preferred way of preserving Jewish life in the land of Israel, of course, is a controversial plan to encourage or coerce the transfer of hostile Arabs from the land of Israel, his intense desire to create a truly Jewish state, a Torah state, and not, as he coined, a state of Hebrew-speaking Gentiles. He didn't mince words, and of course this did not endear him to the establishment, not the religious Torah establishment, or though some surprises await, and certainly not the secular Jewish or non-Orthodox establishment. Compromise was not in his vocabulary, and in that sense, he was an extremist. My Rebbe, Rabbi Chait, used to say, not necessarily about Rav Kahana, that extremists are either completely right or completely wrong, but either way, people can't stand them. It's like the Jews who had to ask Moshe to utter the Dibros after the first two were uttered by God at Sinai, because the reality of God's presence was too overwhelming. So too, hearing the unvarnished truth is like staring at the brightness of the sun. People have to turn away. He was a Talmud Chacham, loved to learn Torah. His weekly columns in the Jewish press, for whom he served as an editor and columnist for almost 30 years, which was the main source of his paltry income, were peppered with Divrei Torah. And some of his works, for example, I have a few of them, but Or HaRa'ayon, about the Jewish idea, or Perish HaMakabi on different Svarim and Chumash and Nach, both contain wonderful scholarship and are great resources as well. So he went to jail many times. He was once threatened with jail time in Israel if he didn't discontinue his activism. And he said, "What's the difference whether I learn Torah in this room or in that room? It's the same Torah." And yet there was another side. He was passionate, and his passion sometimes gave way to impatience or curtness. Occasionally even rudeness to people in the audience. He did not suffer fools at all. And although he loved to argue, he didn't love to argue for an extended period of time. I think of all our subjects, I probably had the most interaction with him, not that he knew me at all. I must have attended maybe 10 or a dozen of his lectures, because he was always entertaining and always on message. But at least in my experience, he would frequently insult and mock members of the audience with the sarcasm known to New Yorkers, maybe also people from Brooklyn, who knows. When he was running for the Knesset, one of the times I went to hear him speak in Netanya, and after he said that he hopes to win 3 or 4 seats, I asked him, who are the other people on his list? You know, you can't serve one person 4 seats. So he chewed my head off for asking such an impertinent question. To me, it seemed like a reasonable question. He never did answer it. He used violence as a tool to achieve his objectives, or maybe better said, we'll get back to this, the threat of violence. And he occasionally attracted people prone to violence also. On the positive side, he attracted many people to Torah and mitzvot who otherwise would have been lost. And on the other hand, some of them carried baggage with them, including a propensity for violence, some of which was a reaction to the Holocaust, when Jews were beaten and degraded and murdered. So he felt his generation could not accept it, and sometimes in excess. He loved publicity, I think he would say that himself, but he used publicity to draw attention to his causes. And that inspired a generation of activists, and often worked, but there's a personal price that's paid for the need for publicity. To feed that desire, you have to keep doing more and more, and even more and more outlandish things. So at rest and sit-ins and broken windows and bombs and threats and phone calls were all used to get attention. And he was a master at it, a PR master. I remember this vividly. There was once, probably still exists, a Reform rabbi in Miami who ran a conversion factory, obviously not valid. Kahana showed up at his temple one day, meaty in hand with a billy goat, and asked that the rabbi convert the goat, since the goat had a white beard. He looked a little Jewish, even more Jewish than the converts he was converting. If there was one common denominator between his activism and his Torah and his shenanigans, it was this. Everything was done because he loved Jews. Everything. He loved Jews who disagreed with him, who challenged him, who thwarted him. He felt sorry for them, and he redoubled his efforts. He desperately tried to get his contemporaries to love Jews, and often castigated other rabbis, Rosh Yeshiva, and leaders for their passivity, their acquiescence to the status quo, and especially what he saw as their fear and cowardice. Fear to confront enemies of Jews openly, midah keneged midah. Fear of making aliyah and leaving the fleshpots of the exile. Fear of teaching the whole Torah and not just parts of it. Just fear. Sometimes what he called fear maybe was prudence or a difference of opinion, but he saw it as fear. And for all the controversies he was involved with, and sometimes the harsh exterior, he had a heart of gold. He impacted the lives of tens of thousands of people, raising up disciples, keeping the true faith, bestowing chesed in hidden ways. So his wife, Libby, Shlivim Be Well, has written now 2 exhaustive volumes about his life, about 800-900 pages in all so far, covering his life up to the time he entered the Knesset. So she writes that during the Shiva, someone came and told her, maybe it was a person herself, that he once heard of a single mother in Yerushalayim who was on dialysis and finding it increasingly hard to get to the hospital. So he had no money, but he ordered for her a home dialysis unit, $7,000. On his next trip to America, he went to a wealthy person's home. The guy rudely greeted him in his bathing suit, wet from the pool, and within a few minutes, Rav Kahana had $7,000 that he needed to pay for the unit. I'll add, the woman was a complete stranger to him. So what drove him? How was he in the forefront of so many issues? Why didn't his life take a more conventional turn, remain a pulpit rabbi, teach in a yeshiva? How did he become such a legendary figure, and what was his legacy? The only rabbi in the series, Rachman al-Islan, to be assassinated, and by an Arab terrorist at that. Well, Rabbi Kahana was born August 1st, 1932, in Brooklyn, in the nadir of the Depression, 3 months before FDR was elected for the first time. His father, Rabbi Yecheskel Shraga Cohen, Rabbi Charles Kahana, was born in Tzfat in 1905. He went to learn in Poland, then in Pressburg, went back to Tzfat, and then joined two brothers in America, where he got a second smicha from Reitz. So his father became a pulpit rabbi in Brooklyn, spent much of his career at Shari Tefillah in Brooklyn on Quentin Road. He married, this is Rabbi Charles Kahana, Sonia Trainin in 1931, and her brother, Rabbi Isaac Trainin, for many decades headed the religious department of the Federation. So Kahana was frequently at odds with his own uncle. Rabbi Kahana Sr. helped reestablish the Mir Yeshiva in Brooklyn, where Meir would later learn. And of course, he has one younger brother. His younger brother, Nachman, shall live and be well, is today the Rav of the Young Israel, the Old City, and the author of the famous Mei Menucho series on Tosfos. In 1938, four of his relatives in Tzfat were murdered by Arabs. He was 6 years old at the time. During the attacks on Jews in that period, it was very prevalent, so prevalent that the Irgun was formed right then, the Etzel. Undoubtedly, the loss of the relatives had an effect on him. But what had a greater effect on him and his worldview was the Holocaust, to which we will return. Meir Kahana attended Yeshiva Flatbush, and then BTA, and really a typical upbringing for his era, baseball and friends. Very interestingly, he began to stutter severely in high school, and his parents sent him to a clinic in Rhode Island to try to overcome it, and he was a controlled stutterer for the rest of his life, blinking and using hand motions to distract himself from his typical speaking patterns, one of the techniques that he used. Very odd, considering that so much of his life became public speaking. So he arrived in high school, weak in Talmud, by his own admission. Yeshiva Flatbush emphasized Hebrew language, but he worked hard, became the literary editor of the school yearbook. He had a lifelong love of writing, and he also in high school joined Beitar. Remember, this is the years right before the establishment of the state, and he was frequently out of school. Not surprising that he joined Beitar, which became known for its protest demonstrations, all to call attention to the plight of Jews in DP camps, and of course in the land of Israel, fighting for statehood. Now, in tactics that would later be duplicated by the JDL, his Beitar group stormed on one occasion the British consulate to protest the hanging of Dov Gruner, Hashem Yikom Damo. They took over British offices, cultural institutions. He joined with his father's encouragement. He later acknowledged his father's profound influence on him. And he considered himself a devotee of both Zev Jabotinsky and then the Rosh Beitar, Menachem Begin. And really the Hadar of Beitar spoke to him. Jewish pride, dignity, royalty. And no doubt all this was spurred when the reality of the Holocaust unfolded. Not just the murder of 6 million Jews, many killed without physical resistance, but even more galling to him was the silence of American Jews, the establishment fear of rocking the boat, the reliance on government officials and their platitudes, especially including FDR, who for strange reasons remains a hero to Jews, despite his basic lack of interest in the fate of European Jewry, and even his frustration of rescue efforts, including not bombing the Auschwitz crematoria, but other things as well. So Kahana was part of a movement, small at first, that would take Jewish destiny into our own hands and not rely on princes and non-Jews. Years later, he was asked in an interview, how can a rabbi be arrested? You know, how's a rabbi protesting, demonstrating? We're the Rosh Yeshiva. And he would answer, why were no Jews arrested protesting in 1943? Where were the Rosh Yeshiva then? Passivity, dependence on others for our survival, does not work. What did the Holocaust mean to him? It meant that every attack on a Jew would be met with a counterattack, that every Jewish life and asset would be protected, that violence to protect Jews was a virtue, not a vice, and that the state of Israel is the place of Jewish destiny. If you want to understand everything that Meir Kahana stood for, look to the Holocaust. If you want to know why the establishment hated him, look to the Holocaust as well. They hated that he harped on their failures and their timidity. He left Beitar in 1951, joined Bnei Akiva. Holding up Beitar was meaningful until there was a Jewish state, but now that the state was established, it had to be infused with a Jewish character, and that was through Bnei Akiva. Torah Vavodah. He was a very charismatic leader in the Bnei Akiva. Rosh Sniff, or Rosh Ken, how do they call it, emphasizing love of Torah, Israel, and Aliyah. Rabbi Rakefet, Rav Aaron Rakefet, and his wife Malka were two of his charges. And through Bnei Akiva, he met the woman who would become his wife, Libby as well, whom he married in 1956. She was 18, he was 24. Love at first sight. Meanwhile, before then, he entered the Brooklyn College Night School in 1949. He began learning in Meir by day as well. Graduated college in 1954. 5 years for night school is actually pretty quick. Studied political science and history. Received smicha in 1955 from Rav Avram Kalmanovich, the Meir Rosh Yeshiva. Another great influence, because Rav Kalmanovich had been one of the most tireless activists during the Holocaust, focusing all his time on rescue efforts and violating the law if necessary. So Rav Kalmanovich himself rescued thousands of Jews by getting them visa, and he became the couple's Masada Kiddushin. Kahana then entered law school, New York Law School, simultaneously got a master's in international relations from New York University. So he got his law degree and master's in 1957, but he never took the bar, assuming he was making Aliyah right away. So he was sidetracked. And again, you see how history sometimes turns on the most interesting vignettes. In January 1958, armed with all his degrees, had a BA, a law degree, and a master's, he sailed to Israel to find a job and find a place to live for himself and his wife. So his daughter recalled, he told this story. En route to Israel by ship, he shared a cabin with seven other people, and one secular Jew walked in on Shabbos fuming because he had been up on the deck smoking a cigarette, and a chassid came and knocked the cigarette overboard. And this fellow walked into the room. The roommate was cursing all religious Jews. And then Meir Kahana would tell his children that when he was in yeshiva, he was once walking with his Rebbe on Shabbos, and they sat down on a park bench next to a smoker. The Rebbe realized the smoker was Jewish and said to him, "My friend, you probably forgot today is Shabbos." And the man threw away his cigarette. And Kahana said, "That's how you're supposed to talk to non-observant Jews." Israel wasn't as welcoming. He applied for a job in the foreign ministry, well-credentialed as he was, and he wasn't rejected, he was ignored, only because he wasn't a member of the Labor Party. Then he applied for a job as the rabbi of Kibbutz Sa'ad, and he didn't get it. His stuttering in English was controlled, but his stuttering in Hebrew at the time was uncontrollable. So rather than reject him, they also didn't answer him, but of such things history is made. He returned to New York, and he soon became the rabbi of the Howard Beach Jewish Center. There, before he took the job, he insisted they put in a mechitza, and they resigned from the United Synagogue, the conservative temple, and they agreed. While there, he posed two questions to Rav Moshe Feinstein that we have as number one and number two. They found their way into Igros Moshe. Bekohen she'ein lo raglayim v'holech beraglayim shasul and yinasiyas kapayim. This is from Kvodo, Milos Kvodo, Yedidi, Morena, Harav, Merkana Shlito. The question was, a Kohen had returned from fighting Korea, missing a leg. He had a prosthetic device with a shoe at the bottom. And the question was, could a Kohen who takes off his shoes, could this person duchen? Rosh went through a whole year, I think we discussed it once on a Friday night here, and he said that the Kohen Kedushin, otherwise it would turn him off completely, be depressed. The second tshuva was actually the same day it was sent, is actually prescient. He asked Reb Moshe about Chagigas Bas Mitzvah Beveis HaKnesses. So of course, his essence in the shul was Kiruv, and to draw the children in. So he wondered if a boy is having a bar mitzvah, and of course it was a big event in temples and synagogues at the time, not today as well, could they do the same thing for a girl? And Reb Moshe was not too keen on it, as we know, and he says it's not a Sudas Mitzvah. It's like a birthday, it's a reshus. You can't make it in shul, sudas reshus. But if they want to make a kiddush in shul, so that they can do. But this question too, it's in the Or HaChaim Chelek Daled Siman Lamed Vav, is on his name. He was successful in a way in his shul. The membership almost doubled in the first year, but he lasted only 3 years. They voted him out. He was unabashedly Orthodox. And he wrote and demonstrated that the non-Orthodox movements were not genuine and would lead Jews to assimilation and intermarriage. And of course he was right. And he emphasized especially teaching the children of the shul Torah. One thing his wife writes, he taught Arlo Guthrie, Woody Guthrie's son, for his bar mitzvah, because the mother was Jewish. But he taught children about kashrus and Shabbos. He sent some kids to Tiferes Moshe Elementary School in Queens, but then a rebellion started. The people in the shul, too many, resented the fact that the children were coming home and telling them they need to have only kosher kitchens. And they want to be in a Shomer Shabbos home. And the parents were afraid that children were coming too religious. And in 1961, they voted to remove the mechitza just to get rid of him, because they knew he wouldn't stay. Apparently the breaking point was when the president's son told his father that he's going to YU for college. And that did it. So although he was a hero in Mir, he gave up a job because of fidelity to Torah, something many rabbis did not do in those days. He turned to writing and he became an editor at the Jewish Press, addressing the issues of the day. At first halachic topics, then public affairs. It became his primary source of income for most of his life. And the most he ever earned from the Jewish press was $200 a week, which even in the 70s and 80s was really not that much money. But money he never had. His columns have been reprinted by the family. It's a 7-volume work. To read through them now is to see how prescient he was in so many areas. So what were the issues he addressed and confronted time after time, article after article? So we have a few here. One was non-orthodoxy, especially rabbis. If you turn the page to number 8, this is from 1961. I just cut it short at a particular point, but he said every person faces a moment of truth. It's called free will. It's often called the spirit that is man. It is also always called courage. It is not an easy thing for a man to give up a life of indolence. It's not a simple thing to ask him to turn his back upon a life of self-indulgence and material comforts. It's difficult for a simple person to choose greatness to leap for truth. It is much to ask a Jew to return to traditional Judaism. And yet he is asked to do precisely that. He is asked to destroy all that was in his past, to cast out his idols, to deny his creations, and to purge his soul, to look at the mirror of truth, to acquire his moment of truth. The non-observant Jew knows, deep in his heart, buried far away, in the inner recesses of his being, he knows. He knows that the path he trods is a false one, that the Judaism he professes is a mockery. He knows that the weird mixture of Sabbath desecration and high holy day synagogue attendance, the kosher home coupled with a meal at the Chinese restaurant, the neglect of prayer joined with strict yard site observance, is a game, a children's game, which is full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. He knows, and then he went on and on. In a later article, number 5, I won't read the whole thing, many here will recall the television show Bridget Loves Bernie. Bridget and Bernie. Bridget, thank you. Bucky. Bridget Loves Bernie, about Bernie, a Jew, married to a non-Jew, Bridget. in the early 1970s, and he hated it that it was canceled, and then he wrote about it, how relatively simple it was to cancel Bernie and Bridget on television, how much more difficult to struggle against the curse and cancer of intermarriage and assimilation that exists in real American Jewish life. And he goes on, what makes Bernie run? What makes Bernie run after Bridget? This is the question that drives the American Jewish establishment to frantically set up committees, study groups, surveys, and commissions. This is the question at the top of their puzzled order priorities. What makes Bernie run? She says, the puzzled shepherds can close down their study groups and their commissions. What makes Bernie run? Who created that Bernie? Why, the answer is obvious. The very same establishment groups who are busily creating the committees, commissions, study group surveys to find out the answer to these questions. These questions, by the way, because the point they underscore to society is the 11th commandment, the American Jew, thou shalt melt. Thou shalt melt, integrate, amalgamate, thou shalt be an American as all others. Well, this is 1973 or 4, he wrote this, and it's hard to say, it's not entirely true today, it's even worse today. But that is the way he wrote. Now, he criticized everybody at one time or another. He criticized critics of Israel. Even praised Ben-Gurion when the Knesset passed the law permitting the incarceration of recalcitrant husbands. He wrote about tzniut becoming a dead letter among the modern Orthodox. He said, the minority is right. Look outside. He wrote about presenting mitzvos in a positive way, so people should not think that Orthodoxy is all about ancient rituals. He criticized talkers, and he praised doers. He began speaking to youth, and he became very popular. You know, in between jobs, he had a lot of side jobs. One year, he bought a newspaper delivery route, delivered papers like from 5 to 7 in the morning, and then spent the rest of the day learning in yeshiva. When there was a strike in the newspapers in New York, he became a sports writer for the New York Daily News, writing under the name Martin Keene. Martin was his English name. And he criticized the yeshivas, including Meir, for teaching Torah in a dry, unimaginative, mechanical way that did not speak to the youth. By then, they were living in Laurelton, Libby and Merikahana. There's some Laurelton people here today as well. Around this time, rumor has it, he became an informant for the FBI under the name Michael King, infiltrating the John Birch Society and reporting on them. There are the lurid rumors as well, but none of that's corroborated. And he later in life had enough enemies that people could fabricate what they wanted in order to discredit him. It was during this period, the early 60s, he became involved in the two causes that would define his life in America, Soviet Jewry and Jewish self-defense. So what came first with Soviet Jewry was writing and speaking. And the activism followed. So who should get credit for the eventual liberation of Soviet Jews is a disputed question, but it's undeniable that Meir Kahane made it a public matter. It's undeniable as well that the Jews in the Soviet Union, many knew about it. Yosef Mendelevich, for example, said even in his time they knew all about Meir Kahane and what he was doing. Until then, the establishment either did nothing or acted around the margins. So the Jews of Silence, written by Elie Wiesel, published in 1965 after a visit to the Soviet Union, so he meant the Soviet Jews, but just as easily could have referred to American Jews. So Kahane decided on the only course of action that he thought had a chance of success, to make headlines, to draw publicity to the cause, to fire up a slumbering people that was still, even after the silence of the Holocaust years, timid, unsure of itself, not wanting to make waves. See, praise SSJ, one of the first organizations to get involved, the Students' Struggle for Soviet Jewry, for picketing Soviet offices better than any other organization, but he said that picketing would not suffice. You have to get more attention. You have to have the politicians get involved. So pressure, arrests, harassment, and the threat of violence and harm would make an impact. He began already in 1963 to write and speak at rallies. And look at number 3. I think it goes back to 1963. It is not, top left, not a pleasant task, but this is not a job for people who fear getting their hands soiled. Soviet Jewry will not wait upon respectability and gentility. It will mean condemnation from the respectable elements within Jewry who fear more for their own image than for Soviet Jewry. But neither is this a place for people who fear getting their reputations besmirched. And he goes on, he said the blacks were successful in gaining their civil rights because of the threat of violence that existed. It's interesting, I spoke last week to a long-time leader and a former activist in the JDL who said to me that Kahana was always against violence. And interestingly, while he headed the JDL, no one ever got hurt unless there was a fight in the streets or seriously hurt. He felt that violence will be counterproductive, that rather than energize the American government to pressure the Soviets, it would subject Americans in Moscow, say, to similar violence. It would escalate the Cold War and would push to the side the Soviet Jewry movement. So what he advocated was the threat of violence, feeling that if the threat was there without the actual violence, it would have a greater effect. So routine harassment, Soviet offices occupied, Aeroflot's offices, cultural missions, accosting diplomats on the street, bomb scares, smoke bombs, stink bombs, the most egregious while he was there, shooting into a diplomat's home in the Bronx, but again in an empty part of the home. No one was hurt, but the arrest became routine. The blocking of traffic and other acts, all really theater annoyances that got attention, publicity, and always with the threat that things could get out of hand if the treatment of Soviet Jews did not improve and they were not allowed to emigrate. His stated goal was to poison the atmosphere between the U.S. and the USSR. So in that vein, interestingly enough, he toured campuses in the mid-1960s as the head of another organization he started, trying to drum up support for the Vietnam War. Talk about a contrarian. Going to college campuses in the 60s to encourage people to support the Vietnam War because he felt that would weaken the Soviets. Now, people always debate how instrumental he was there another way, etc. My own sense is that he brought the plight of Soviet Jewry not only to the masses, the media, and the government, but to the Jewish establishment as well. And the latter never forgave him for it. Acting alone, it's not only him, because he was never that sensitive to the political dynamics. You know, he would push people, but he could never be the Makeh Bepatish. It's analogous question, by the way, to the Irgun. Would Israel have been established without the Irgun pressure on the British? Maybe, but not when it was, probably much later, if at all. See, his contributions to the cause made a difference. They were well known in the Soviet Union as well as to Soviet Jews. Few other rabbis were as engaged in that process as he was. And it's true, in 1971-72, when they're at their heyday, and because of the encroaching detente between Nixon and Brezhnev, tens of thousands of Jews were allowed to emigrate from the Soviet Union. But he was routinely barred, even arrested, but barred from the establishment Soviet Jewry conferences that took place around the world. He would go anyway, force himself in. He'd be arrested as well. He'd probably arrested hundreds of times. Of course, even the threat of violence is playing with fire. So in January 1972, an incendiary bomb exploded in the office of Saul Yurok, the Jewish impresario who brought Soviet Russian acts like the Bolshoi to New York, and a Jewish secretary, Iris Konis, was killed. So poor chroniclers of history blame this on Kahana, but by this time he was living in Israel over a year already. In fact, that week he was celebrating his son Baruch's Bar Mitzvah in Israel. He was no longer involved in the daily management of the JDL, and he denounced this attack as an insane act because it really was... It hurts the cause, not help the cause. 3 JDLers were arrested for it, It was obviously, nonetheless, a stain on his record and the movement, even if he was not involved. But if you call him a murderer, that already is a calumny because he was not involved, didn't even know about it before it happened, as frequently happened as well. It would be like blaming every supporter of the OU if the OU stumbles once in Kashrus and Treif chickens get out there. That makes no sense. But it is true, those who play with fire eventually get burnt. Now, the strike force for the Soviet Jewry movement became the JDL. And the JDL really made his reputation. Part of their mandate was the Soviet Jewry movement, but it began for another reason entirely. In 1967-68, American cities were plagued by the rioting of blacks and incessant attacks on defenseless Jews. What was happening was what Jews, unaffected by it, euphemistically called "the neighborhood is changing." And places where Jews lived for decades, even Harlem, but mostly Brooklyn neighborhoods, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brownsville and others, became inhospitable to Jews. Most Jews fled. The ones who stayed suffered. At the same time, Jewish teachers were being threatened in their public schools, and the jobs were under attack because black groups objected to the disproportionate number of Jews in the school. In July 1968, after months of articles in the Jewish press, the JDL was formed. If you look at number 7, here's the original JDL manifesto. Then it was called, the beginning, JEDL. It's not a racist organization. It's neither right nor left in its philosophy. JDL rejects all hate and illegality. It fights the revolutionary left, so hostile to Jewish continuity in the state of Israel even today. Combats the cancer of right fascism, stands up to the black Nazi, believes in law and order, backs the police forces, special project, the youth of this country, Jewish youth in particular, bring to them the facts and truths of the horrors that troops would impose. Then it goes on with the other aspects of its platform, and you see at the bottom, the big advertisement ended, dedicated to the 6 million with our pledge, never again. It attracted at first hundreds of members, later perhaps in the low thousands. It would march, it would protest, it would carry legal weapons, it would defend Jews in the inner cities. The muscle was affectionately nicknamed the Chaya Squad. And it was summarized, their whole platform was summarized by that slogan, never again, which, as Kahana often stated, when it was co-opted by the establishment, it never meant that a Holocaust could never happen again. That he called, I quote, an absurd proposition. It meant that there would never again be, I quote, that same lack of reaction, that same indifference, that same fear to attacks on any Jew anywhere. As strange as it sounds, the Jewish establishment hated it, and hated more its involvement in the Soviet Jewry movement. They might have thought it wouldn't work, it would provoke more violence, that there must be a better way to be determined. But as we've seen very often, sometimes when people say there must be a better way to be determined, they never quite get around to determining what that better way is. So the JDL made Kahana something of a pariah in the Jewish establishment, and that type of oppositionist mentality still prevails. I'll give you an example. After, you see the difference in worldview after the Pittsburgh massacre a few weeks ago, when President Trump said the shul, the synagogue, like all houses of worship, should have an armed guard, all right? The reaction of liberal Jews was fast and furious, apoplectic. It was not just blaming the victim, a preposterous claim, or hatred of Trump, but one female Reconstructionist rabbi, I don't want to say her name, expressing her strong opposition to the very idea that there should be Jews with guns in shul, said, if we let them change the way we pray, then we let them change our whole religion. Well, I guess the irony escaped her. Her entire movement changed the whole religion. Kahana said differently, every Jew at 22, we have to defend ourselves first and foremost. And notice as well another modern phenomenon. The ADL reports, somewhat breathlessly and a tad exaggerated, that anti-Jewish incidents are at an all-time high or whatever. So they report, they raise money off it. What they don't suggest is Jewish self-defense. They want to end hatred as an emotion. It's a dubious and impossible task. It's actually quite Christian, but it's never worked. Kahana wanted to end the haters, not the hatred, or at least keep them far from Jews out of fear of what might happen to them. So you can decide what works better. I'll mention one point that again shows the contrast. In 1975, a Jew in Brooklyn was mugged and killed, Rahman al-Islam, on Shabbos, because he didn't have any money on him. And two leading modern Orthodox rabbis, I won't say their names, decided to discuss and put forward the idea that Jews should be allowed to carry money on Shabbos in order to pay off muggers. And Kahana mocked them, because obviously there's some other things you can carry to ward off muggers, but the thought did not occur to them. Now, an understated aspect of the JDL was its kirov effect. Young Jews who were often far from Torah observance gained purpose, a connection, and a Rebbe, how many thousands called him Reb up to the time of his death, and a bond with the Jewish people through a sense of Avat Yisrael, for which they would put their bodies on the line. So he established Camp Jeddel. He ran leadership training seminars to train young Jews in his Torah and his thought, and what and how they could do to help Jews. Nuts and bolts, how to run a demonstration, how to write a press release, in addition to the ideology. He did this in America, did this in Israel as well. He was convicted in 1971 for possession of explosives. He was demonstrating explosives at Camp Jeddel under the supervision of an explosives expert, but apparently it was illegal anyway. He was sentenced to probation, but he was eventually sent to jail a few years later for almost a year for violating probation, in that he was accused of fomenting violence from Israel in asking his followers to, quote, do anything necessary to upset the visit to the United States of Leonid Brezhnev. He was already living in Israel, but two things came out of his time in Allenwood. One, he wrote a sefer. And two, he sued the government for the right to kosher food, and he won. Now, I want to just quote a few things here that are of interest. First, number 9 is his statement to the judge before sentencing. He said, "I am not happy being here, even though you are only a judge of flesh and blood. I do not look forward to being put in prison, although that may work, may very well be, but someday I'll have to face a second judge. And with him there will be, I believe, a great many souls. And I believe those souls stand by his side, and when every Jew comes, they have a question they pose to the soul that has just arrived. And that question is, where were you when we cried out? Those are the souls of the Jews of Eastern Europe's Holocaust, and they will also be the souls of the Jews of the USSR. I want to be able to say I was there and I did what I could. I've tried to do what I can, and whether I go to prison or I do or not, I'm going to continue doing what I have to do, and I only hope that the members of the Jewish Defense League and all Jews, no matter what happens this morning, will do what they have to do. Thank you." His wife was in Israel. She wanted to come for the duration of his sentence, but he sent to number 10 a loving note. "Dear Lib, I hope you understand why I do not want you to come to America. Aside from there being no point to it, the children need you there, and I want to put into practice the concept that the Jew has no place in the Galut, and that there is no reason to leave Eretz Yisrael unless there is the direst of circumstances, which this is not. He explained logically, I miss you very much, but I will not miss you less if you come here for a week." Well, he sued and he won. And here's the caption from number 11, United States versus Kahana. So it's so interesting. Judge Weinstein, who sentenced him, allowed him to remain out. He got out for sometimes 3, 5, even 9 hours a day because the prison could not give him kosher food. He's allowed to be out. He's in a halfway house and he could leave. He's come back at night and take care of his needs until, in fact, the court ruled in his favor that if the government is going to imprison Orthodox Jews, they have to provide for their kosher food needs as well. Every Jew in prison who gets kosher food should thank Mayor Kahana for this. Of course, it's still better not to be in prison. He would do anything to help Jews. In 1971, he established a brief working relationship with Joe Colombo, who was head of one of the five mafia families in New York. Alas, he was soon after gunned down. In 1969, needing money, he began to teach at YHSQ, where the students described him as charismatic and as the rabbi in Rochdale Village, again in Queens, but neither job lasted long as he embarked on a new campaign, and that was Aliyah. It's safe to say that few rabbis were involved in public policy issues as much as he was, and the issues he took on were always hot-button issues. He was one of the leading debaters of the Reform and Conservative, as I mentioned, saw them as illegitimate and leading their followers, good Jews but naive, down the path to intermarriage and assimilation. And his articles of the Jewish press ran the gamut of issues: Torah, Israel, Soviet Jewry, non-orthodoxy, politics, race relations, intermarriage, and especially the empty materialism that he said clogged the spiritual arteries of American Jewry. So in his writing, he could be sarcastic and cynical and biting and funny and punny, he loved puns, moving, sentimental, but the issues he addressed as a rabbi writing are broader and more penetrating than any of his contemporaries. He spoke on numerous college campuses, often to hostile audiences. But you watch the videos, they're on YouTube. See the crowds, gauge their level of interest, their engagement, and their response to his call that the most important thing in their lives was their Jewishness, and they should appreciate it and take advantage of it. And then he began writing and speaking about Aliyah. Always difficult for American rabbis because we're here. He wrote a book with a title. You can judge a book by the title, by the way. Uncomfortable Questions for Comfortable Jews, among his 40 books. Another, you get right to the point on the cover, Time to Go Home. So he and his family made Aliyah in 1971, but he did return to the U.S. frequently to speak. In May 1972, he hosted a mass Aliyah conference on Long Island as the only hope for American Jewry. So he lived for a time in Yerushalayim, and then after a few years, he and his wife moved to Kiryat Arba, where he remained until his end. He never really had any money, nor did he complain about it at all. I want to just quote a brief passage from Or HaRayon, which is really an encyclopedic work that takes up 40, 50 different areas of Judaism. It says number 13 here, page Tuf Lamed Dalad. And he speaks about living in the exile and the natural home of a Jew is in Israel. Yisrael hayoshvim b'tumar agalut, Jews who live in the impurity of the exile, u'mo'asim b'kach v'eretz chemdo v'kedushat ha'aretz, and they scorn the desirable land and the holiness of the land, mechalim et shmo shakadosh baruch hu ba'etzem yeshivatam bekev ha'goyim. They defile, they desecrate God's name by the mere fact they're living amongst the Gentiles, tachat ol hagoyim v'ribonutam, under the yoke of the Gentiles and their sovereignty. And they depend on them. All right, he doesn't mince words. You could read it. It gets even a little more harsh. But nonetheless, he left nothing unsaid if he felt it needed to be said. But Israel, even in Israel, he remained a thorn in the side of the establishment. He was perceived as a leader. He was a known entity in Israel already because of the JDL, the Soviet Jewry movement. He was offered a place in Likud, but he turned it down. He even started JDL in Israel until they arrested and reminded him there's an army and a police force. So that did that. But he could not harness himself to any establishment. It was both his great strength and his great weakness. So his issues remain similar, with the addition of somewhat unique to Israel: Jewish pride, Jewish identity. He lambasted the labor establishment that had rejected him 15 years earlier for the spiritual massacre they had committed against Sephardic Jews in the early 1950s. Opposition to any territorial concessions, and then the need to transfer hostile Arabs from the land of Israel for the security of the state and people. Every act of terror was like a dagger in his side, and his book on the issue was simply titled They Must Go. And he initiated a series of protests and arrests. He was arrested multiple times in Israel. One joke he told, he was treated very roughly by the Israeli police, and he complained to them that even in America he was never manhandled this much. And they said to him, that's because here we don't have to worry about the Jewish vote. It was a joke that he told. He was such a critic of the Israeli government of Golda Meir that the Jewish press began censoring some of his articles, saying it was providing fodder for Israel haters. He refused to moderate his views one iota, even to sell them in political campaigns. He maintained that there always has to be at least one party that speaks the absolute truth. If he disagreed with Likud or the National Religious Party Mafdal on one point, that was enough. Even asked to present his views on transfer in more temperate tones, he refused. Harking back to the activism days, the more outlandish, the more the publicity, but of course very often, the less effective you are. And this became a recurring issue. At one point, the Israeli government confiscated his passport, depriving him of the opportunity to visit the U.S. His American passport they took, and the Israeli passport. So friends enlisted the support of Ramosha Feinstein, who called the Israeli consul on his behalf. And this is a part of the Meir Kahana story that's underappreciated. He was an extremist, of course, but extremism in defense of Torah and Jews and Israel. So even if Gedolim could find fault with his tactics, his objectives were always admirable, as opposed to the secular Jewish establishment that opposed both his tactics and his objectives. So for example, he first ran for the Knesset in 1973, came very close to getting in, lost by 2,500 votes, but he did worse in 1977, having been out of the country for a longer period of time, including in jail. But, and he was also being arrested consistently in Israel. But when he ran in 1977, he was actually endorsed by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook, who spoke very highly of Rav Kahana and his ideas. And I'll quote in English. The presence of Rabbi Meir Kahana and his uncompromising words from the Knesset platform will undoubtedly add strength and value to the obligatory struggle on behalf of the entire land of Israel, even if Rav Tzvi Yehuda apparently withdrew the endorsement under pressure from the Maftal. Had Kahana won in 1973, who knows if his life would have taken a different turn. He was close from Mordechai Eliyahu to Shlomo Kalbach. They did work together also in the 70s and 80s. To Rabbi Yisrael Ariel, who was that mystery number two on his list. Today he heads the Machane Mikdash Yerushalayim, and others. There were others, other American rabbis, famous names, moderates, who saw him as a resource, didn't shun him, but tried to guide him to do good in a way that would be acceptable to all. Many self-styled liberals tried to deprive him of his right to free speech, something that is now de rigueur, but first starting in the 1980s. So he enlisted in the IDF. He could have gotten away with some pro forma service because he was in his 40s already. But he insisted that basic training and then Miluim, his brief service in Ramallah in 1982, was also legendary. The Arabs were told he was coming and they were so afraid of him, they stayed inside their homes. See, he remained vocal on all the issues of the day in America, in Israel, even though he formally stepped down from the JDL in the early 1970s. He was uninvolved in day-to-day affairs from 71 on, but he formally resigned in 74, and the organization, within a few years, was a non-entity, but he kept fighting. He fought against the Nazis marching in Skokie. He turned on his hero Menachem Begin because of the Camp David Accords. He fought against the withdrawal of Sinai, from Sinai and Yamit, even though he was called back from America by a general because some of the remaining settlers in Yamit had threatened a mass suicide. They flew Kahana in to Israel, then on a military helicopter to Yamit, so he should talk to them and talk them out of committing any rash acts. He wound up in administrative detention several times for months at a time. He was often prescient, but not every prediction was on target. So for example, unless you think of the long term, In 1979, he opened in the Kacha headquarters on Rehovot Sishkin, Yerushalayim, the Museum of the Potential Holocaust, about the coming destruction of American Jewry. So I visited twice, I have to tell you. I found it a bit overwrought, exaggerating the influence of neo-Nazis in American society. He thought American Jewry had barely a decade. So now it's four decades later. Draw whatever conclusion you want. Doesn't mean it can happen, but it hasn't happened. Nor is it on the horizon. He wrote a book in 1986 called 40 Years, that 1988 was the decision time for Israel to go one direction or another. It wasn't. But in Israel, he finally won a Knesset seat in 1984 as leader of the Kach party. Now, people focus on only one part of the platform, transfer, but the Kach platform endorsed everything that Kahana had been advocating for years. Torah, mitzvos, Jewish identity, love of all Jews, settlement, Soviet Jewry, etc. But he became famous or infamous for the transfer plan. It offended the left-wingers' humanism and dreams of peace and coexistence, and offended the right-wing parties, mainly because of the potential for loss of votes. Remember when Rehavam Zevi, Hashem Yikom Demo Gandhi, embraced transfer as the platform for his Moledet party just a few years later, somehow he wasn't deemed a racist, nor was he banned, although he was also murdered. In fact, Gandhi, with his transfer plan, was a minister in the government. So taking all the emotion and the high-sounding talk out of it, the cold facts are that population transfers have a long history to them and have worked to reduce strife and violence between two warring peoples. So, for example, after World War II, almost 12 million ethnic Germans were driven out of Eastern and Central Europe. Perhaps 2 million died in their travel west. In 1948, almost 13 million Hindus and Muslims exchanged places in India and Pakistan. And the political argument can be made, as some did, that the Middle East saw an incomplete transfer. 800,000 Jews were expelled from Muslim lands and absorbed by Israel. About half the Arabs in Israel fled, a quarter million remained, but full transfer was never completed. So it was plausible, it's a little difficult to digest, immoral to some minds, but much more moral to others if it avoids constant friction and terror and violence and death. Whatever the merits, certainly debatable in light of history, it made Kahana a pariah, and it's still on the agenda, but very understated, and I don't see a political way to carry it out, even if people would deem it the right way. Now, once he was elected, President Herzog refused to meet with him, breaking with precedent. He met with all the party leaders, even Arab terrorists. So Kahana returned the favor, calling Herzog in public, Chometz ben Yayin, vinegar the son of wine, meaning a bad son to an illustrious father. But you have this very interesting letter in number 12 that was made aware of by Rabbi Rakefet a few weeks ago, or a few months ago. It was a letter that Rav Soloveitchik wrote in November 1984 to President Herzog, calling for him, asking him, it was on YU stationery, asking him to meet with Kahana. And he says, "Hinini mevin ki chvodo mitameis anhig atzmo tafigido haram berov tov chochmo." He says, "I know, I understand. You try to do everything with the wisdom, and there are many different calculations you have. Afal pichain tamar b'fi. I have a bitter taste in my mouth. V'gam lo yuzbar li. It's not understandable to me. Lama haya alav lazmin nitzigei hamiflaga nitzigei Arafat v'chevem ratzchov." Why do you invite to meet with you the representatives of Arafat and his band of murderers, Umein Lahazmin at Rabbi Kahana, Nehru, and you don't invite Rabbi Kahana? And you know that he's roughly not impressed and involved in politics, etc. But he says, it's four lines from the bottom of the first paragraph, Im Kain, Heyot Rameir Kahana, Shu Ktsat Tamil Chacham, little Tamil Chacham, Lamrod Kame Vekame Mishigonotav, notwithstanding some of his, madness. Who Yehudi Yirei Shemayim, Hanocham LeTorah Ulechod Shem Shemayim Lechod Yisrael. He's a God-fearing Jew who fights for Torah, the honor of heaven and the honor of the Jewish people. Ein Chas V'Shalom Lashvotel LeGruim Shebein Porkeah Ovecha Yisrael. You can't compare him, God forbid, to the inferior people who thrown off the yoke of Torah. And he said, I'm writing to you directly, so you shouldn't hear different things in my name, from my Talmidim here and there. And he says, Lu Yoshomei Alatzati, if you listen to my advice, and you now invite kahana ki bal meretz umesiras nefesh kazo yesh lematein vaoz yoel ha'il. If you invite kahana who is a courageous person, and he has his courage and his enthusiasm and his mesiras nefesh just need to be moderated, and then it'll be beneficial. Then everyone benefits. And then, by the way, he called upon President Herzog to be a shomer mitzvahs in public, to respect the state and respect his father as well. Well, the plea was turned down. This was found in the archives of Chaim Herzog. Kahana would constantly boast that his support was growing, and there were polls that indicated he would get 3 seats, 4, 6, as much as 13. He happened to have been a diligent legislator in the 4 years he was almost never missing a session, but with few accomplishments because he had no support. And to him it was clear, he said it openly, Israel should be a state of halacha, something that frightened everyone, even the religious parties, for reasons they should explain. Now the reaction to him corrupted Israeli democracy in ways that led to some of the excesses of the next 20 years and the utter disregard, even contempt for minority views. For example, the Knesset passed a law in 1984 that no one with a foreign passport could be a member of the Knesset. It was just a law that would force him to give up his American passport. And he did. Knesset passed an anti-racism law in 1985, which eventually the Supreme Court upheld, resulting in the banning of the Kach party in 1988. No other party was subject, even the Arab parties who call for Israel's extermination, they're not subject to it. So they just passed laws to stick it to him. He still traveled, spoke, wrote, but it was a terrible blow, one that he thought would eventually be reversed. And once this happened, that he was deemed a racist by the Knesset, so shuls in America started banning him as well, even places where he had frequently spoken in the future. He started a yeshiva in Israel that still exists, Yeshivat Or HaRayon, the light of the idea. He wrote that sefer I quoted before, or a comprehensive book on the Jewish idea, ranging from Omachus Shemaim and Avas Hashem and Avas Yisrael, laws of war, Israel, Mashiach, Gog Umagog, role of non-Jews, Kiddush Hashem, and many others. It really is an encyclopedia. November 5th, 1990, speaking to Jews in the Marriott Hotel on the east side of Manhattan, he was shot in the head by El Sayyid Nosser. Kahana had refused any special security. His funeral the next day in Brooklyn at the Young Israel of Ocean Parkway attracted thousands. It was a cold day. I was there myself. Rabbi Tendler was one of those who eulogized him, saying that Meir Kahana had one objective in life. How do you make each Jew stand tall? And his burial in Israel, Har Nuchot, attracted thousands more. But nothing came easy. And even in death, he had what to teach. El Sayyid Nosser, if you remember, was acquitted by a Manhattan jury of homicide, convicted only of possession of a gun, even though he was shot at the scene and arrested right outside. So much for justice. He was later retried on federal grounds of violating Americana civil rights by killing him, and he was convicted of that. That's why he now has a life sentence, although he did come up for parole, which was denied a few months ago. But you can trace a straight line between the Arab terrorist cell that killed Kahana, that blew up the World Trade Center in 1993, and that flew planes into the Twin Towers on September 11th, 2001. There was tremendous overlap in the group, from Nosser to the blind Sheikh to Bin Laden. So many today say that this was the first act of Arab terror on American soil, the assassination of Meir Kahana, and had the authorities been more astute, the later terror could have been averted. So obviously he died al Kiddush Hashem, and his legion of critics should therefore be duly cautious in evaluating his life. He and Libby had 4 children, many grandchildren. His son, Binyamin Zev, and his wife, Talia, Hashem Kom Damam, were murdered December 31st, 2000, on their way home to Tapuach on Kvish Yishim, the settlement in the Shomron that has many Kachlikim, was founded by a Kach. That was part of the Arab wave of terror that was so predictable and which evoked a lot of wringing of the hands. No, so how would history have been different if he had lived? think about it, it's always the fate of the young. Meir Kahn would be 86 today, had he lived. Someone suggested to me last week that Baruch Goldstein would never have murdered Arabs in 1994 had his teacher remained alive. Would Oslo, of course we'll never know, would Oslo have unfolded as it did? Would the expulsion from Gaza have taken place as it did? There was opposition, but nothing like Meir Kahane could have done as a charismatic leader, as one who put his life on the line for Jews. Who knows? His ideas still live on, the good and the challenging. His collected writings, mainly his columns, can be read today and are still relevant to the modern debate and not historical curiosities. It was always clear to me, besides the passion, was the breadth, the range of issues he discussed. His fiery public personality combined with a warm and loving inner spirit that made him unique in the 20th century rabbinate. And he did have a tart tongue. Number 14 is an interview he gave the day of his death that was published a few days later. The questioner said, "I must return to a previous point, since so many people raise it. The lies and defamation and attacks on you must surely wear you down. How do you cope with it?" I answered at least in part, but let me add a bit to that. To begin with, one rule is basic. Never respond to vicious and filthy lies that are clear attempts to defame and destroy and that are funded and planned by enemies of the Jewish people. When one responds to these things, that is exactly what the enemy wants, since it only helps to publicize the defamation. When one gets into the mud with the swine, one must emerge filthy. King David said, "They who hate me without reason are more than the hairs of my head." But he also taught us how to react to the haters. "I will keep a curb on my mouth while the wicked one is before me." And then, classic Kahane, in a word, one does not bark back at barking dogs if one is a person and not a dog. No one else achieved what he did, not the successes, not the failures. But he did light a fire under American and Israeli Jewry that still burns, or at least flickers. No one replaced him. And so his movements suffered in his absence. But as a leader and lover of Jews, it's hard to find his equal. And there's some sense of unfinished business natural when someone dies at 58. But had he moderated even a little, worked with others rather than always against, maybe would have impacted the world practically rather than just ideologically or rhetorically. But it's hard to think of another rabbi who took on the issues he did and that animated so many people with the love of Jews that he had. I thank you all very much. So next month, we'll go back to a little more conventional rabbi and look at the life and times, I think, of the Kloisenberger Rebbe. Thank you again.